In a few minutes, a new lesson on how language is power, the short declarative sentence that may have turbocharged the opioid epidemic. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. The percentages 21 and 37 are in the spotlight as the House and Senate try to bolt their tax plans together. A House-Senate committee is holding a rare open meeting this afternoon during which they'll try to work out differences in the tax overhaul. There's pressure from the White House to get this done before Christmas. Marketplace's Andy Euler is following this. Andy, where are we? Is consensus in the air?
Well, David, there are still a few important things in the bill that still need to be hammered out. After negotiations last night, it seems that the corporate tax rate, which is currently at 35%, will be getting a significant reduction. But instead of that 20%, which was initially the rate in both bills, a lot of reporting out of Washington saying it looks like lawmakers now plan to bump that up to 21%. And that's going to free up a few billion dollars to spend on other parts of the bill. Because so much of the argument has been about how lawmakers are going to pay for this bill. Under Senate rules, the final bill can add no more than $1.5 trillion to federal budget deficits over a decade.
All right, but what about individual tax rates? Do we have any idea what's going to happen there?
It looks like we might be close to an agreement on how much to reduce the tax rates for high-income households. There's a talk of reducing that rate of anyone making $1 million annually to 37%, but that would cut back on revenue. It seems like the 1% bump in the corporate tax rates hoping to make up for that. Now, none of this talk helps senior Republicans deflect any criticism that this bill is set out to help the rich. Maine Senator Susan Collins, widely seen as the critical swing voter if this bill is going to pass, has said she doesn't think lowering the top tax rate is a good idea. But wealthy people in states like New York and California have argued they're going to be paying more state taxes under the plan. So the idea of a nationwide reduction is looking to ease some of those concerns.
All right, Andy, thank you. Let's check the markets. The FTSE in London is up a smidgen, call it treading water. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are also little changed as we await confirmation in about 7 hours' time that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates for the third time this cycle. 10-year Treasury yield is up 2.41%. As a nonprofit organization, Marketplace is on a mission that drives what we do every day, to increase economic intelligence across the country. We believe it's important work, which we're already doing, and right now would be a great time for you to help. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism you can trust, and the payoff comes with what you hear every day. Don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org, and thank you. More than 300,000 people have died from opioid overdoses since 1999, and another 2 million are addicted. 2 million. This disaster is getting attention, but here's something that you may not have heard. Some of the opioid epidemic's roots may lie in a couple of short English sentences. Caitlin Esch from Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk is coming off an 8-month investigation into how the painkiller OxyContin happened. Caitlin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you set out to look at the roots of the opioid crisis to see if government regulation played a role?
Yeah, we wanted to look at the regulations that brought OxyContin to market 21 years ago. We ended up looking at Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, and we found that a lot of it comes down to the package insert, also referred to as a label. And it's this powerful regulatory tool that the FDA has over the pharmaceutical industry. And while a patient might not look at this document, it's really important for how a drug can be marketed. So we zoomed in on a couple of sentences out of hundreds in the original label from 1995, sentences about abuse and addiction. And some of these sentences turned out to be very problematic and were ultimately removed in 2001.
So these are English sentences that even I would understand. Give me a sense of them.
One sentence that we looked at was delayed absorption as provided by OxyContin tablets is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug. So in plain English, that means that because OxyContin is supposed to enter your system continuously over many hours rather than all at once, like immediate release opioids, because of this feature, it's believed that people will be less likely to abuse OxyContin The problem is that sentence turned out to be highly misleading, and OxyContin, we know now, turned out to be highly abusable.
A statement like that, some would expect, would be backed up by evidence, maybe even clinical evidence.
Yeah. We know from depositions that Purdue did not do any clinical studies to test OxyContin's abuse potential, but they did do market research. So we obtained a focus group report that Purdue commissioned in 1995 as the FDA was approving OxyContin. There was a main recommendation that came out of it, and it's do clinicals, and if you can prove that OxyContin has a lower abuse liability, that'll really help sell the drug. Now, we have draft labels from before and after the focus group report. A draft label from before, you can look at it, and there is no sentence about abuse liability. Then the focus group happens, and there's a draft label after, and a sentence about abuse liability has been added.
Right now, Purdue is involved in more than 100 lawsuits by cities, counties, and states involving OxyContin. But what is your sense, Caitlin, if these infamous sentences never would have been included, do you think history would have been different, that abuse levels would have been reduced?
I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to that. Those sentences came out in 2001, but for more than 5 years between 1995 and 2001, they were a key part of the marketing campaign. We can see that in internal marketing documents and depositions.
And do we have a response from Purdue?
Yes, Purdue declined an interview, but they did send a statement, which you can read on our website. And they basically deny that the focus group report influenced the label. And they maintain that the FDA regulates their product and that it was safe and effective.
And the FDA, they had a response?
The FDA also declined an interview, but you can read their statement on our website. They said they're focused on learning from lessons of the past to inform their actions going forward.
Marketplace's Caitlin Esch, thank you.
Thank you.
The investigation took Caitlin to a tiny courthouse in Appalachia, to a parking lot with a mysterious black car. And listen to this, to the Emerald City in the land of Oz. Much is revealed about how we regulate things that can hurt us by signing up to a new season of Marketplace's podcast called The Uncertain Hour. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. It's from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.